money invested too heavily in ties with Europe. The Europeans showed that they were powerless in the face of the US monetary hegemony. Because when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, or in other words, ended his commitments under the deal, the Europeans were unable to uphold the 11-point pledges they had made to Iran. Therefore, one of the mistakes Mr. Rouhani's government made was being over-reliant on the Europeans, who didn't do anything for us. But of course, Europe stood against the US demand for triggering the so-called snapback mechanism, rejecting it with 11 abstained votes. Also, the Europeans abstained from voting for a US-proposed draft resolution seeking an indefinite extension to an arms embargo on Iran.
Of course, Europe's approach may not be a determining factor, as US President Biden insists on the continuation of Trump policies as leverage in negotiations. Europe's role is actually one of coordinator, and it is using its capacities to help in pressuring Iran into accepting terms beyond JCPOA demands. That is to control or even scrap this country's defensive ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Two demands Iran finds outrageous and insulting. Iran also does have the opportunity of showing more goodwill by accepting FATF terms and agreeing to return to full compliance with the deal in return for the US's lifting of only nuclear deal-related sanctions, FATF being the Anti-Money Laundering Financial Action Task Force. But this country feels no obligation because it was the US that pulled out of the deal to begin with, and that was a deal that laid Iran bare to surveillance and sabotage. Talking of turning challenges and problems into opportunities, Iran and Europe have plenty of common interests to consider in matters such as energy, the fight against drugs, the fight against terrorism, and advanced technologies to enjoy. The path to getting there is detente and confidence building that would result in purposeful interaction. But that's enough on a single deal that Iran cast most all of its chips into. There's a world beyond out there. In the absence of a Western alliance, Russia and China have been powerful allies to Iran, even overpoweringly so. By 2019, China had gained control of under 48.5% of Iran's exports and 27.5% of the country's imports. There's no place like home, and it's regional alliances that Iran and its neighbors must recall for their very livelihood in their match against nature itself. Water scarcity paints a scary future when 12 out of the 17 most water-stressed states in the world are in the Middle East and North Africa. Iran and its Arab neighbors to the south must cooperate to promote water security while minimizing harm to the Persian Gulf's ecology. Attention tends to focus on geopolitical challenges and economic exchange, but working together on water might open the way for meaningful cooperation on other issues. Focusing on the usual concerns, however, Mr. Beheshtipour talks of lost time with Saudi Arabia.
Mr. Rouhani's failure included Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, those who stormed the Saudi embassy and set it on fire were responsible for the strained relations, but Mr. Rouhani was unable to improve the ties afterward. This continued until recently before negotiations with Saudi Arabia kicked off. We hope the talks are successful, because resolving the problems between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have a considerable impact on ending the devastating war on Yemen. It will also leave a positive impact on Iraq's stability and security.
While we're on the subject of neighbors, the current government got to enhance ties with Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And it's got to solve some problems with its Azerbaijan ties, as well as differences in relation to Turkmenistan and the purchase of gas. Our analyst awarded Rouhani and his foreign policy team that praise, but said how balance must be maintained henceforth. The sum of it all sketches a close-up of Iran in total, its situation and status on the world scene. Geopolitics are a determining factor. Iran is the bridge between East and West, and any government can make the most of this natural positioning if it plays its cards right.
Another important point about Iran is its population. Iran is a country of over 80 million. Its people are highly educated. Its youth have excellent abilities and have shown them in different historic projects, like a nuclear program. They are self-reliant and have been able to do a lot. Therefore, Iran has the capacity to produce knowledge. It has the power of its population. It has economic power.
Ultimately, to our guests, the most important political game now is the challenge and opportunity that is the very JCPOA. Iran can live without it, but should it come to an agreement over that nuclear deal, it will have found a well-designed pattern for international exchanges. And those will facilitate better utilization of domestic capacities even. Whatever plans the different candidates have for different economic issues would make or break them in the presidential race. Issues are inflation, poverty, unemployment, and skyrocketing prices for basic household goods. Principalists or conservatives blame problems on the Rouhani administration's looking to the West to solve the country's economic woes. The question today is, what will they, the candidates, bring to the table? Dr. Shaghoghi is Dean of Khwarazmi University's Faculty of Economy. He came to share his views with us at Press TV Studios.
Any cabinet that will take office would face these problems and challenges, which have escalated compared to the previous decade. As time passes by, the problems worsen. Another point to mention is that all the think tanks are predicting by 2030 no country would buy oil. This means an end to the oil exports era.
Dr. Raghfar is an economist teaching at Al-Zahra University, where we met him. He mentions the main reason for a high inflation rate.
The main reason behind the rise of inflation in Iran is what's called the costs push, which is mainly caused by currency manipulation. Iran's inflation has ranged somewhere about 14 to 15%, when there haven't been wide fluctuations in the value of our national currency. But in the past 8 years, the inflation in Iran averaged 24%. The highest inflation level was recorded last year at 50%. It was mainly caused by the devaluation of the national currency, as I just mentioned.
Hassan Rouhani didn't inherit a bed of roses when he started out as president in 2013. International sanctions had been tightened in 2011, and inflation was at over 30%, and there appeared no way out but to negotiate a deal with the world's economic powers. That would be the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal with the P5 plus one, the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. They would lift the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. The U.S. pulled out, however, in 2018, and made things worse for this country.
The 11th government took office with a promise to solve Iran's nuclear-related issues, lift sanctions, and improve the country's international ties. But the nuclear negotiations that were expected to be wrapped up fast took about 2 to 2.5 years to conclude. Even after JCPOA was reached, several issues, including banking relations, were left unsolved. The government put all its eggs in the basket of the nuclear deal.
Although it may not be tangible, the Rouhani government is said to have kept the economy afloat, when it could have actually drowned by U.S. sanctions, the oil revenues frozen abroad, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Not sure our Dr. Raghfar agrees.
It appears to me that we have all the resources to fund the public sector, but there isn't a political will to get that done. The fact that the government hasn't turned to taxes and that Iran's tax system is flawed and inefficient depends on how much they fit the interests of the decision makers.
Now, Iran's problem is indeed also corruption and mismanagement, not just external sanctions. Whatever weakness or malice and vice the government may have, it is not the ultimate force in the country to carry all the blame. The government needs tax revenues it cannot extract from the most powerful institutions or invisible incomes. It attempted selling bonds for public companies and enterprises, but those basically didn't land in the palms of actual private companies and investors who get the industry running and so create jobs. Dr. Hakhshanas is a prominent economist who was, for his tireless capability, appointed governor of Golestan province when floods swept over the country in 2019. He joined us on Skype.
What the incumbent administration did was, instead of borrowing from the central bank and injecting stronger money into the economy, it attempted to address the budget deficit by selling treasury bills or other securities worth 200 trillion tumans. If the government didn't take this initiative, Iran's economy could sink into hyperinflation, as many experts were predicting following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018.
Plenty of solutions suggested by economists, but do any plans and ideas put forth by presidential candidates read with those solutions to economic woes? Let's hear it from an expert. Have you seen any concrete economic plans by the presidential candidates?
I haven't seen any candidate with a comprehensive plan so far. I don't know if they have a plan, but they are yet to publish their agenda through the media or on their websites. The plans have to incorporate the priorities, including those for reforms, operations, how to address major challenges, their quantifiable goals, approaches and strategies. You see, a team of doctors must have a plan that identifies the challenges facing the patient, prioritize which ones to address first, and determines the necessary treatment.
It's come to that time when any guess as to who the next president is can be second-guessed, when the expected outcome can make a U-turn. That's because electoral debates are underway. The first round was on Saturday, the 5th of June, and that was the economic round, when candidates could have recreated their destinies. Overall, the debate between the seven candidates wasn't impressive. Although the seven were to respond to predetermined questions, they basically seized the opportunity to respond to criticisms and attack one another and the outgoing Rouhani administration, or to promote their own plans.
We need to do things like levying taxes on non-productive jobs and at the same time reducing taxes on producers.
When we carefully study the matters, we realize that the government's relationship with the economy and the economies with the people haven't been adjusted. Whenever the government faces a problem, it delves into the pockets of the people.
Dear Iranians, your economic conditions can be improved a lot, but that necessitates reforms that the other candidates can't make. But I have the plan and the ability to do so, dear people.
Unfortunately, in our country, the relevant authorities have become responsible for the protection of foreign currency instead of being responsible for protecting the value of the national currency.
Statistics show that almost 50% of people live below the poverty line. This doesn't befit the honorable people of Iran, that 7 million heads of households don't earn a fixed income and need direct assistance to make a living.
The volume of liquidity is more than 3,500 trillion tumans. This is brought about by banks producing money without the supervision of the central bank, creating super debtors. Currently, there are 11 super debtors who owe the economy 90 trillion tumans.
Before making plans to fight poverty, you need to ensure that you have the attitude for it. Do you have what it takes to fight poverty? One of the problems we have had over the past years has been that the people and the underprivileged haven't been the priority.
But for the better part, the debate circled around criticizing the present government's policies and Abdel Nasser Hemmati's efficiency when chief of the CBI, Central Bank of Iran.
Dear Mr. Hemmati, you have sources to make kingpins for steel, sugar, and cooking oil, but you don't have resources to help the poor. He has destroyed the national currency. Now he's talking about the distribution of poverty. You have distributed poverty.
For instance, Mr. Hemmati said why the FATF hasn't been approved, claiming that you know so much about the issue is why the economy is in the condition it is right now.
Hemmati, for his part, tried to exempt himself from the government's policies, saying Hassan Rouhani lacked economic vision.
First of all, let me say at the outset that I'm not Mr. Rouhani's representative. I was set aside from the central bank because of disagreements I had with Mr. Rouhani. He had the same problem you do. He didn't have economic insight. I urge everyone to consider this. Mr. Raisi said two groups of economists can comment. But if you don't have economic insight, which group do you listen to? It's an issue that's been solved everywhere in the world. Anyone who makes economic decisions must have economic insight.
I asked how Hemmati had won the reputation with many of having kept the inflation and decline of the rial under check against all odds. The many don't include our economist.
In an 8-year period, when Iran saw war, occupation, political coup, and other turning points, only once the national currency fell sixfold. That happened in a 3-year period when Mr. Hemmati was in charge.
Mohsen Mehralizade praised the 8-year performance of the Khatami government, calling his own policies a continuation of that reforms government.
People of Iran, all their statistics and political, social, and historical indicators are a testament to the fact that one government managed to advance the country appropriately toward development by moving slowly, steadily, and logically. That was the reformist government of Sayyid Mohammad Khatami.
As for Sayyid Jalili and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, those were the two candidates that focused on introducing their own plans more than the others did. This means they spent less time on attacking fellow candidates.
You need to be able to create jobs, not add employees. This means that your agricultural sector should be able to do this. We checked how much work can be done in the petro-refinery sector, petrochemical, oil and gas projects, and energy consumption optimization. Also in agriculture, fisheries, farms, animal husbandry, and etc. We have transformative plans for each of these.
We've been making plans with the help of revolutionary youth over the past 3 years under the title of Salam Government. I can address the production barriers, structural budgeting, non-repayment of debts, bank debtors, and tax issues.
In saying why he wanted to leave the judiciary for the executive, Mr. Raisi highlighted his fight against corruption, the source of which he said was mostly the executive, which he wants to reconstruct.
During my tenure in the judiciary, I faced numerous cases which are traced back to the executive branch of the government. I mean legal cases of corruption and economic rights. We investigate these cases with a steady perseverance. People know well that I know no borders in dealing with corruption cases, and it's been proved to them that I'm not all talk. I'm a man of my words. It's a key point that today we need to promptly deal with and correct the branch of the government which is producing such cases.
We popped out to see what people on the street were thinking, how attractive they found the candidates and their mottos. We also asked people whether they associated economic problems with sanctions or domestic mismanagement.
The point is that sanctions have become an excuse for mismanagement inside the country. If they select qualified managers with relevant knowledge and expertise to the area of their activity, we won't have the problems that we have today in the country.
I wish there were more severe laws against presidents who simply forget about their campaign slogans as soon as they win the elections. That's my personal idea, though. Because in that case, they will stay in office for 4 or 8 years and just exacerbate the problems.
For me, who is grappling with problems of life every single day, baseless slogans won't do any good. In fact, we've been able to find ways around the sanctions, but unfortunately, mismanagement is still prevalent throughout the country.
Sanctions will not always be like this. Things will work out. Actually, we need to find a way to cope with mismanagement.
Pressure of sanctions is undeniable, but still the country enjoys enough potentials to flourish. The fact of the matter is that we've heard loads of these slogans since many years ago, but it's not enough. A tongue doesn't get things done.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
When ordinary people all over the world can see the dangers and pitfalls of following the United States as a model and a leader, why do their neoliberal leaders keep showing up to lend credibility to the posturing of U.S. leaders at summits like the G7 and NATO? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis, authors. This article is published under the heading, Why Democracies in G7 and NATO Should Reject U.S. Leadership. Stay tuned for more. The world has been treated to successive spectacles of national leaders gathering at a G7 summit in Cornwall and a NATO summit in Brussels. The U.S. corporate media have portrayed these summits as chances for President Biden to rally the leaders of the world's democratic nations in a coordinated response to the most serious problems facing the world, from the COVID pandemic, climate change, and global inequality, to ill-defined threats to democracy. But there is something seriously wrong with this picture. Democracy means rule by the people. While that can take different forms in different countries and cultures, there is a growing consensus in the United States that the exceptional power of wealthy Americans and corporations to influence election results and government policies has led to a de facto system of government that fails to reflect the will of the American people on many critical issues. So when President Biden meets with the leaders of democratic countries, he represents a country that is in many ways an undemocratic outlier rather than a leader among democratic nations. This is evident in the legalized bribery of 2020's $14.4 billion federal election, compared with recent elections in Canada and the UK that cost less than 1% of that under strict rules that ensure more democratic results. A defeated president proclaiming baseless accusations of fraud and inciting a mob to invade the U.S. Congress in January 2021. News media that have been commercialized, consolidated, gutted, and dumbed down by their corporate owners, making Americans easy prey for misinformation by unscrupulous interest groups, and leaving the U.S. in 44th place on Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index, the highest incarceration rate of any country in the world, with over 2 million people behind bars, and systematic police violence on a scale never seen in other wealthy nations. The injustice of extreme inequality, poverty, and cradle-to-grave debt for millions in an otherwise wealthy nation. An exceptional lack of economic and social mobility compared to other wealthy countries, that is the antithesis of the mythical American dream. Privatized, undemocratic, and failing education and healthcare system. A recent history of illegal invasions, massacre of civilians, torture, drone assassinations, extraordinary renditions, and indefinite detention at Guantanamo with no accountability, and, last but not the least, a gargantuan war machine capable of destroying the world in the hands of this dysfunctional political system. Fortunately, though, Americans are not the only ones asking what is wrong with American democracy. The Alliance of Democracies Foundation, ADF, founded by former Danish Prime Minister and NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, conducted a poll of 50,000 people in 53 countries between February and April 2021, and found that people around the world share our concerns about America's dystopian political system and imperial outrages. Probably the most startling result of the poll to Americans would be its finding that more people around the world, that is 44%, see the United States of America as a threat to democracy in their countries than China or Russia, which makes nonsense of U.S. efforts to justify its revived Cold War on Russia and China in the name of democracy. In a larger poll of 124,000 people that ADF conducted in 2020, countries where large majorities saw the United States as a danger to democracy included China, but also Germany, Austria, Denmark, Ireland, France, Greece, Belgium, Sweden, and Canada. We take solace from evidence that the people of Europe, whom the NATO war plan counts on as frontline troops and mass casualty victims, are not ready to follow President Biden to war. A January 2021 survey by the European Council on Foreign Affairs found that large majorities of Europeans want to remain neutral in any U.S. war on Russia or China. Only 22% would want their country to take the U.S. side in a war on China, and 23% in a war on Russia. The antipathy of ordinary people everywhere toward the U.S. determination to provoke military confrontation with Russia and China begs serious questions about the complicity of their leaders in these incredibly dangerous, possibly suicidal U.S. policies. When ordinary people all over the world can see the dangers and pitfalls of falling the United States as a model and a leader, why do their neoliberal leaders keep showing up to lend credibility to the posturing of U.S. leaders at summits like G7 and NATO? Maybe the leaders of other wealthy countries and military powers are genuinely awed by the dystopian American dream as the example par excellence of how to sell inequality, injustice, and war to the public in the name of freedom and democracy. In that case, the fact that people in other wealthy countries are not so easily led to war or lured into political passivity and impotence would only increase the awe of their leaders for their American counterparts, who literally laugh all the way to the bank as they pay lip service to the sanctity of the American dream and the American people. Ordinary people in other countries are right to be wary of the Pied Piper of American leadership, but the rulers should be too. The fracturing and disintegration of American society should stand as a warning to neoliberal governments and ruling classes everywhere to be more careful what they wish for. Instead of a world in which other countries emulate or fall victim to America's failed experiment in extreme neoliberalism, the key to a peaceful, sustainable, and prosperous future for all the world's people, including Americans, lies in working together, learning from each other, and adopting policies that serve the public good and improve the lives of all, especially those most in need. There is a name for that. It's called democracy for people.
The debate.
Britain and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 international summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
It was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the US president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through US politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. The whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, which was a binding international agreement, which they've signed onto. And the terms that they've agreed for to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, I mean, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end results of this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties, and the utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, you know, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland, because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet himself, you know, yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson, he claims that the EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain. But again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much wanted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this exit, premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, you know, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs, you know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which
right.
is now gradually going to get exposed.
Go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU's threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson and his posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, that they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreements as they agreed be actually implemented. You know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland. They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And you know, the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. It's much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. And, I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whoever is constructing this, whether they actually want, from British policy making side, whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, you know, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is going in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folk that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically. You know, 20-30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions, and they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which, you know, prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French President Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered. They could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals, but they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs, and it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. He didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, you know, the real tragedy of Britain is there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in there's a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know, the union was a Conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. But again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line. Whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc. That's also going to be, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. Brexit, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe, how that was one thing which, also was mooted. It was one of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone. The strength of its currency was higher, But again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then of course the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, the labour shortage that I briefly mentioned would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants who from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants, there's been a massive exodus in I think almost some quotes I've had are up to a million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence the intelligence networks,
sure.
The sharing of information which was there on the cards, that's all going to be much, much more difficult to sort of access. They're not going to be as freely giving that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbas. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also, thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also, special thanks to you.